Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a physician who has developed a career that has blended writing with the practice of medicine. He is a cardiologist and also author and poet. His name is Michael Lacombe, and he's visiting here, the campus of the University of Illinois. His visit sponsored by the College of Medicine. He's spending some time talking with students and was good enough to come by and spend a little time talking with us. Let me tell you just a little bit more about him. He's a graduate of Harvard Med School. He's practiced medicine for over 30 years in rural Maine and is former director of cardiology at Maine General Medical Center in Augusta, Maine. He's published a number of books, one full-length book of medical advice for a general audience. He's also contributed to books including Empathy and the Practice of Medicine Beyond Pills and the Scalpel. He edited and contributed to a third on Being a Doctor. He's editor of the On Being a Doctor section of the Annals of Internal Medicine, which is one of the big medical journals up there with the Lancet, JAMA, and New England Journal of Medicine. He edited the Medicine, Science, and Society and Reading for Survival sections of the American Journal of Medicine. And more than 100 of his stories and essays have been printed in publications including the Journal of the American Medical Association, the American Journal of Medicine, and Hospital Practice, among others. Also, a collection of his stories will be published by the University of Maine Press this summer. We're pleased that you could spend a little time talking with us, and as we do, questions, comments certainly are welcome. And the number to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
There are a number of celebrated doctor writers, so I don't know if there's something in particular that makes those two things go together. Have you always been interested in writing?
I have. Someone once said that being a doctor gives you a ticket for the front row on the drama of life. And I think that feeds physicians who are interested in writing. It certainly gives you material, grist for the mill. Especially to write fiction, which is what I do.
And at what point in your life did you decide that you wanted to be a physician?
I wanted to go to college and save the world from the communist threat. Sputnik had gone up in 1959. State and federal governments were throwing money at students to become scientists. And when I got to college and looked around at my fellow physics and chemistry majors, I discovered that wasn't for me, and so took a test, went to the guidance office, and they gave me personality tests and all of this and said, you should be a doctor. And I said, well, I'm not rich enough. Only rich kids can be doctors.
Mm. So, well, tell us about where you grew up. So did you grow up in Maine?
No, I grew up in extreme northern New York on the Canadian border, on the St. Lawrence River. Went to the University of Rochester as an undergrad, and then to Harvard Medical School.
Yeah. So somehow that seems to be fairly exclusive. Not everyone gets to go to Harvard Med School.
No. And I went there rather naively. I was asked by these personality testers and guidance counselors at the University of Rochester if I would consider going into medicine, and they gave me a book on medical schools, and I looked at the data and said, well, Harvard seems to be the best one. I guess I'll go there.
Do you know what it was at that time they were looking at it in terms of personal characteristics that made them say a particular – you or any particular person was suited to be a doctor? They would look and say, oh, well, this person should be a doctor.
Yeah, good question. The combination of a strong interest in science with a strong interest in people and in the humanities. And I ended up switching to an English major when physics got tired of me.
You know, it strikes me that when young men and women go to medical school, they sit there in the classroom and they read their textbooks and they learn a lot of important things, and their professors teach them a lot. But you really only become a doctor when you start to work with patients. And I suppose you could make the argument that, in fact, it is your patients that teach you how to be a doctor as much, maybe more than what your professors have taught. But that also points to the fact that this, the relationship between the doctor and the patient is important, and you wonder, is this something that actually can be taught? The thing that we used to call, maybe people still call, bedside manner. Is that something that you can teach?
It is something that you can teach. It's a very good question. But it's not always something that you learn. It's not always something that is taught. Teaching about patients, teaching about bedside manner, necessarily means teaching at the bedside. And in my experience, and this has really been studied and written about, that occurs about less than 20% of the time when medical students on the wards are being taught by professors. So less than 20% of the time are they actually brought to the patient's bedside. It usually, instead of being bedside teaching, it's hallway teaching or conference room teaching with bagels or door jam teaching, but that doesn't involve getting right to the bedside. When you get to the bedside, the professor teaches by example, and the good students learn therefrom. Students who have no interest in that and who are primarily focused upon paying back burdensome loans, getting the Tony cottage on the lake, whatever, oftentimes are not interested in that art of medicine and are only interested in the economics of medicine and in getting ahead, and so they don't learn it.
Yeah. Do you find that there are a lot of people who are choosing to go into medicine simply because they say, well, that's the way to make a really good living?
I don't think that's where it starts. I think that there are certainly easier ways to make a good living. Mm-hmm. But what happens is that these days, the burdensome student loans, which often are $150,000 to $200,000 at the end of a student's education, are so enormous that they see themselves locked into a highly remunerative subspecialty. And so in internal medicine, which is my general field, they often choose cardiology or gastroenterology because those are very procedurally oriented. They can make huge amounts of money, often starting at salaries of $300,000 plus, and can rapidly repay these loans. Whereas something like, say, family practice or general internal medicine would not afford them that opportunity. So they don't enter medical school that way, but we do it to them.
Yeah. Well, is there something that could be done about that, about the staggeringly high cost of medical education?
Well, in an ideal world, of course, sure, state and federal funds could be made available to pay for doctors' educations. The political argument about that is obvious. Doctors make a good living. Why should we help them out with our tax money? I think in a real world, though, there are things that can be done. And I often tell young students and young residents that whereas in my day I had a mandatory military commitment, these kids today can take a commitment to extreme rural areas where they have no doctors. And these small communities and hospitals are so eager to get medical care that they will help the students amortize the loans. Most small community hospitals have a loan amortization program. They don't like to talk about it. But if a young resident goes there and says, you know, I'd like to try this out for 3 or 5 years, and you ask about this, the hospital will say, we'll write off 20% of your loans for the next 5 years. Their hope is that you plant the daffodils, you get your kids in school, and you become a member of the community and you never leave.
Mm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Dr. Michael Lacombe. He is cardiologist, also author, poet, associate editor of the Annals of Internal Medicine. He's here visiting the University of Illinois. His visit here sponsored by the College of Medicine, here to talk with students. And questions here, welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Maybe I mentioned he'll be giving a talk on the subject, A Medical Humanities Conversation, that will be at 12:15 today at the Medical Sciences Building Auditorium on South Matthews in Urbana. And I believe that certainly anybody who's interested in hearing what he has to say should feel welcome, not just It's not just for med students. Other people can stop by and hear him as well. And here on the program, too, questions welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I guess I think myself going back to the, you talked a little bit about medical education and young students, young would-be doctors, and how it is they learn to try to talk to people and figure out what's going on with them. It seems to me that if you know, one of the chief complaints people have about the way medicine is practiced today is that they don't get to spend very much time with their doctors. They really want to have the opportunity to talk about what's going on with them. And they want the feeling that the doctor knows them as something more than a collection of symptoms or a medical history. You know, what now is increasingly computerized. They've liked the idea that the doctor is going to have some idea about who they are as a person. And I think you can also make the argument that that can be an important diagnostic tool for the doctors as well.
Oh, absolutely.
But again, I suppose that goes back to there's a structural thing, that is, the time has to be given for that to happen. But that's also something that you as a physician, I think, has to learn how to negotiate. How does one, aside from the structural thing, which is another case altogether, how is it, I suppose this goes back to my thinking about how it is you teach med students to relate to their patients.
I think all good doctors would like to have the luxury of time to get to know their patients and to talk to them. And they feel the pressures of the mortgage, the loan repayments, the car payments, whatever else, all of the expenses that we all have to meet. And so they truncate office visits, patient appointments, such that the interview time with the patient becomes extremely focused. Without getting into the details of how to run a practice economically and make money, a physician needs to realize that there are methods of having it both ways and that one should be very wary about joining a high-paying practice or healthcare system that is basically a mill, basically a treadmill that gets patients in and out, because neither physician nor patient will be happy with that. It can be done. It is done. But it's important to have it start from day one so that you're off on the right track. In terms of learning to do this, it is vital for medical students, I think, to spend time in a community, in doctor's offices, and see various styles before they commit to a particular way of life.
Let's talk with a caller here. We have somebody in Naperville, which is up in the northern part of the state, on our toll-free line, line 4, right here. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
My question is, what about taking away the pull toward getting paid a lot of money to be a doctor, and bringing that more down to earth, doctor's pay, and also looking into why it costs so much to educate medically. You know, should it really cost as much as it does to get a medical education?
Well, I'm certainly not the one to answer the particulars about the costs of a medical education. But when I graduated from medical school, my total debt was $4,600. And you can compare that today with the typical medical school graduate owing, as I said, about $150,000. Reimbursements for medical school education for university medical centers are down. As you know, payments from Medicare, Medicaid are contracted. Third-party payers contract payments. And so these institutions get the money from somewhere. And some of these kids have enormous debt. Some of the medical students that I teach in the Northeast have debts somewhere in the excess of $300,000. So there is no quick fix. As long as payments to healthcare facilities are truncated like this, you need to understand that to run a university hospital that educates medical students and young doctors is more costly. And the federal government has increasingly failed to reimburse that. And university medical centers suffer from it. The reasons for the increased costs run the gamut. Young doctors tend to overtest. Patients tend to stay in for longer periods of time than they do in efficient, privately run hospitals. So I think for the foreseeable future, the costs are going to be there. And the trick is really, how does one pay for the costs without forcing these kids to go into these high-tech specialties and really become nothing more than proceduralists? Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Do you think that at the bottom of all the layers is greed on somebody's part?
Sure. I have said to, I guess at my age I call them kids now, I have said to my students that the three chief diseases of doctors are arrogance, greed, and intellectual laziness. And there was a great psychiatrist from Kansas who once treated doctors and exclusively treated doctors. And he said that he was able to cure a doctor of everything, of philandering, of substance abuse, of manic depressive states, of suicidal ideation, but he had never been able to cure a doctor of greed. Once that sets in, it is depressing to watch and an awful phenomenon to view even from the inside. Large groups, and I'll talk about my own subspecialty of cardiology, become bent on ever-expanding spheres of influence. We call it turf battles. They are caught up in bonuses, increasing amounts of salary, and it is at the bottom of things. You're absolutely right.
What about a sense of entitlement that doctors have?
Are you a doctor's wife by any chance?
No.
Sure. I mean, they going through this process of 4 years of medical school, preceded by 4 years of a very intense undergraduate education that is contingent upon good performance to get into medical school, and then followed by this very arduous training program and residency, can leave one with the sense that the world owes me something, that I have postponed gratification for so long that I've got it coming to me. And without sounding like a saint who has just flown into town and is leaving tomorrow, let me say that doctors are entitled enough just to be doing what they're doing, taking care of patients and having the ability to do the good thing without having to have money involved in it.
Thank you. That's right. Fascinating.
Well, thanks for the call. Other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. So it sounds like it goes without saying that if I asked you, if you had it to do it all over again, would you still be a doctor?
Yeah, it goes without saying.
Say yes.
Yes, I would.
You would say yes. Yeah. Because it strikes me that there are physicians who've been in practice for a long time. Maybe they're the ones that would be getting near the age of retirement who, given the constraints on practice now, particularly people who have to work in and around managed care, who might just say, you know, I'm not sure. If I had to do it over again, I'm not sure that I would be a doctor, that I might be something else. I don't know what that would be.
Absolutely. And I've been fortunate in where I practiced and in what I've done. I am an employee of a hospital. They take care of all of my office expenses, overhead, insurance, papers, all of that. They fill out the reimbursement forms. And I just have the luxury of seeing patients and pretending that I work for nothing and I don't charge them. Mm. And I've never really had the burden of managed care. I have, in all honesty, not pressured for raises or better salaries. I have been primarily interested in protected time for writing. And so I have been very easily able to resist invitations to go elsewhere at three times the salary.
Yeah. Have you always been a cardiologist? Were you ever more of a general practice internal medicine doctor who would see a wider range, people with essentially a wide range of.
Well, that's a clairvoyant question. You must have read a biography of me somewhere. I spent the first 18 years of my professional life as a general internist in a very rural town of about 5,000, in a small internal medicine group where I had the cardiology expertise. And after 18 years, with the increased success of writing, the increased requests for editing from the journals for books, the practice was not able to accommodate that. And so it became a choice, either stay and not do those things or leave the practice and continue to follow those dreams. I chose the latter course, which was very difficult. And then in order to get protected time and to make myself more marketable, turned toward doing non-invasive cardiology, which basically means all of cardiology excluding catheterization and stents angioplasty. I had developed that expertise as a part of my group, and with some time away and mini sabbaticals, I was able to fill in the gaps and begin to perform that way. Yeah. So I've spent roughly 18 years as a generalist and roughly 15 years as a cardiologist.
Yeah. I ask the question because it seems to me that based on that kind of experience that you were seeing a lot of different people with different kinds of complaints, even though that it was kind of a specialty that you were dealing with heart issues, but that your experience there would have been maybe a little bit more like what it would have been to be a doctor 50 years ago. A little bit more where you were seeing a wide range of people, different ages, different kinds of concerns, and I suppose that's essentially what family practice doctors do.
Sure.
Now.
Sure. I was, during those first 18 years, routinely making house calls, routinely going to funerals of my patients, routinely socializing with people who were also my patients. Because if you don't do that in a town of 5,000, you don't have any friends and you don't have any patients.
Well, I suppose that you would be lucky enough to develop that kind of relationship. And in a sense, you would want to, maybe you would have to. It would seem that it would be almost unavoidable to do that. If it was a small enough town where you were living with the people that you were treated and you could very well treat entire families and you could treat people and you could treat their kids. And, well, I don't know if you were there long enough so that you treated the children of people that you treated, but that there would be, you know, that opportunity to do cross-generational kind of thing and you know, know everything there was to know about everybody.
Sure. I when I got there very early on, I think I'd been there 1 year, the family practitioner who delivered babies for the hospital was trapped in a snowstorm. I was in the emergency room and got page stat to the OB floor, and a woman was about to deliver. And, of course, I'd had no experience in that since medical school. But did the episiotomy, which involves a slight cut of the bottom of the vagina to allow for the birth, as the head was coming out, and delivered this baby. And the family practitioner arrived in time to sort of clean up the mess, and I did fine. 17 years later, this kid walked up to me in the hospital, sort of a gawky kid with jeans and this big grin, and he said, "Dr. Lacombe?" And I said, "Yeah." And he bent over and he showed me this little nick on his scalp. And he said, "You did that to me 17 years ago."
God, that's a great story. And what did you think at that time?
I remembered the kid's name, or at least the family name. And I remembered the incident quite well. And I said something like, you know, we try not to do that with every delivery, something very, you know, studious and professorial. But yeah, it was a wonderful synchronicity.
Yeah, and an experience that I'm sure that not many doctors today are going to No. Going to be able, they will not have a story like that to tell.
No cardiologist later. Will, I'll tell you that. No,
that's right. We're a little bit past our midpoint, or right at our midpoint. Again, I'd just like to introduce our guest, Dr. Michael Lacombe. He's a cardiologist. He's also an author and a poet. He's here as a visiting professor, talking with students at the med school here in U of I, Urbana-Champaign. He's somebody who has managed in his career both to be a physician and to be a writer. He is a graduate of a Harvard Med School. He practiced medicine for over 30 years in rural Maine. He is former director of cardiology at Maine General Medical Center in Augusta. He's published a number of books, one full-length book of medical advice for a general audience, other kinds of writing that are really directed toward doctors and medical students. He's editor of the On Being a Doctor section of the Annals of Internal Medicine. That's one of the big medical journals. He has published a lot of writing of his own. He's more than 100 of his stories and essays have been printed in publications, including the Journal of the American Medical Association, the American Journal of Medicine and Hospital Practice, among others. And he has a collection of stories that will be published by the University of Maine Press this summer. Is that
That's correct. Right? Yes.
I wasn't paying attention to my phone banks here. I got a full line of callers here. So let's pick up the telephone and talk with some more people who are listening. Next up, or the first person in line, maybe I should say that, in Kankakee, line one. Hello.
Hey. Yeah, hello. Hi, yeah. I just kind of had a comment. I was just going to share something I heard. I don't really know about the if it's true, but I just heard that in sort of ancient China, like the Chinese medical doctors, that the way that they were paid was you pay them when you were well, and when you were sick, you didn't pay them. I just always thought that was a pretty interesting twist on things. So yeah, I just wanted to share that.
Sure. Well, paid only when there are results, huh?
Good idea.
So yeah. I like that story. Is that something that you've heard?
I just heard it. I don't really know if it's true. Someone just told me it, but I just thought it was pretty interesting, and it sounded like it could possibly be a lot more effective.
Well, we do have something now called pay for performance, and maybe we are getting back to that. But many of the managed care organizations now look at how a doctor performs. For example, a pediatrician that inoculates, vaccinates all of his kids gets paid more. So maybe it's a good idea that's coming back.
All right. Well, thank you. Let's talk with someone in Champaign next. This is line number two. Hello. Somebody there in line two in Champaign? Well, okay. How about let's try line three in Urbana?
Hello.
Yes.
I have sort of a medical clear. I'm not sure. It's just a puzzle that's been bothering people in our family for a while. As a preface, my grandparents and my mother all died of some sort of a stroke or a heart attack. And they were talking about, before they died, of course, a sound that they heard. And I was wondering, does the person have the ability to hear what's going on in their circulatory system? I mean, I've heard of, you can...
Okay. I'm sorry. We seem to be having a little problem with our phones this morning. And I ended up cutting off the caller. My apologies. If the caller would call back, we'll get her back on and we would get the rest of her story. Was there enough there that you could have something to grab onto? Or maybe we'll just have to ask if the caller can call back and give us a little bit more.
Certainly the bit that we got has scientific merit, and it if it concerns the caller, one should see a generalist with the idea that there may be some sort of vessel abnormality. The most common thing is cholesterol narrowing of the arteries going to the brain on one side, and people who have families who have cholesterol problems and who have accelerated deposits of cholesterol often will get this abnormality in the carotid arteries. And they may hear the brewery or the noise produced by the narrowing. So it's a valid concern.
Okay. I wanted to get back to the caller here on line one. My apologies. Yeah, I was the one who got you cut off. So anyway, tell us the story again.
Oh, well, I wasn't hearing what the doctor was saying, so I don't know. what he was talking about. But, yes, there was a noise that they talked about, and I wasn't sure if people can actually hear what's going on in their circulatory system to that level, but they said it was like a hiss or something. Is that something that you can comment on?
Yes. The most common thing that occurs to me would be a cholesterol abnormality in your family. Mm-hmm. And as you know, that is oftentimes very strongly inherited, so that it goes from one generation to the next. There is an extreme predilection for premature atherosclerosis or cholesterol deposits and narrowing of the arteries.
Mm-hmm.
That occurs commonly, as you know, in the neck vessels and in the carotid arteries, and ultimately can give rise to stroke and severe disability or death. If the narrowing is severe enough and located in the right location, patients are often aware of the noise of the blood going through this obstruction.
Oh.
So your complaint or your concern has merit,
mm-hmm.
and it is something that you should have investigated if you have concerns,
yeah.
with this sort of preamble. And
yeah.
you can say that David Inge sent you.
Oh, great.
Okay. Well, I
and
haven't.
He tells me he gets a cut. So you may want to note something about
his part in this.
His part in this. So, that's correct.
I understand.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
See, the danger of making jokes like that is that someone might actually believe you. Let's talk next with someone in Newton, Illinois. This is line number 4. Hello.
Yes, I. I've read the data about heart disease and stroke, which are the leading causes of death in America, and of course, diabetes. What I'm most interested in is your comments about it. I hear a lot of internal medicine family practitioners today are complaining that their job is getting much more complicated at less fees, and that the specialists come in and do a stent or they do a bypass, get paid large sums of money. And the real crux of the problem today seems to be preventive medicine, where people are hypertensive, half of them are some figure is they're not taking anything, and the ones that are being treated are not being treated adequately enough. And Walmart's generics at $4, often even for combination therapy for hypertension, and for diabetes medicine, there's generics, and there's cholesterol medicine that have generics that, you know, to me it seems that this should be a national program to prevent disease at a very reasonable cost, and if we did this, we would probably have a lot more people that would be at least their bypasses and strokes would be delayed or at least diminished for a number of years. I'd like to hear your comments about that. Thank you.
So, very good issue, and certainly you're very much to the point. Preventative medicine or preventative cardiology in this case is extremely important, and it makes every bit of sense to spend a few dollars on preventative medicine as opposed to thousands and millions of dollars on invasive cardiology, namely stenting and or bypass. There are some things that are being done on a national level. One of the biggest risk factors for premature coronary disease is smoking. And so the national campaigns and the Great American Smokeout, those things are good things, and they deserve our support, and patients need to be steered to them. Smoking is a very difficult, addictive disorder, and one needs to eliminate that risk factor. Beyond that, you are also right in identifying diabetes. There is a syndrome that is not in the public awareness, but should be, called the metabolic syndrome, which features a number of things, including high blood sugars or a predilection for diabetes, cholesterol abnormalities, hypertension, and large waist circumference, male or female. And that metabolic syndrome is a very dangerous disorder because of its risk for premature coronary disease. So that not smoking, getting exercise, maintaining an ideal body weight, and then looking at fasting blood sugars, blood pressure, and cholesterol profiles are really the mainstays of preventive medicine as it relates to premature coronary disease and to stroke.
Does that get at your question, caller?
I think it does. My concern is that, you know, we've had antihypertensive medicines on the market for over, especially diuretics, for over 50 years. What I'm concerned about is the fact that why can't we have better programs that get people to take their medicine, either compliance or education, that there's no reason that we could probably treat the metabolic syndrome with three different types of medicines for hypertension and diabetes and for before they become, I guess you could use metformin, but some of these other agents, and for cholesterol, we could probably do this for under $20 for three different regimens, and if we did this in enough people, I'm afraid the cardiologist would be looking for some unemployment for some of them because of the decrease, tremendous amount of increase or decrease in cardiovascular deaths. And I just don't understand why this is such a simple process, why this is not being done on a national scale where we bring in people, check them routinely, and even reimburse them for this minimal amount of cost of medicine. Most of these medicines have very little side effects these days, and I'm just appalled at why this can't be done on a national scale.
I am appalled, too. And what you're suggesting implies cutting out the pharmaceutical industry. And you and I both know how powerful that industry is. You have no idea the power of direct-to-consumer advertising, those incessant, continual ads on evening television that hype the trade names for all of these drugs that in generic form can often be obtained at much lower cost. But patients are sold on the idea that these drugs and no others will save their lives. A national program would ask for a political will, and a political will to do this, I am afraid, would be subverted by pressure from the pharmaceutical industry, for one thing. I would be all for you in putting 9/10 of the cardiologists out of work, and you're absolutely right in suggesting this. I think the politics, though, are what are difficult.
Yeah. I appreciate the comments of the caller. We just have about 15 minutes, and I've got another, at least one other person that I'd like to get to. Just one point. I guess there were some people who might suggest that cardiologists are never going to be out of work because, well, people know what they should be doing, and we know that lifestyle has a lot to do with heart disease. People don't do it. They know it's good for them, but they don't do it. And I'm sure that that must frustrate a lot of physicians because they advise their patients, and there's plenty of information out there available to the general public about what the risk factors are for heart disease and how you can lower your risk. But we're not doing it.
That's correct. There has been a study of patients who undergo coronary bypass and who are told to clean up their acts. The awareness of this and the act lasts for about 6 months. And then denial takes place. They forget about it. They stop exercising. They may resume smoking. They go back to their old habits. So it is a difficult conundrum. One vignette. I saw a surgeon in my office recently who has all of the risk factors for premature coronary disease. He has, after my initial visit some 6 weeks ago, he has lost 20 pounds. He is working out for an hour every day. He is on a modified Dean Ornish-type diet, taking his statin. Cholesterol has plummeted. His blood pressure is fine. Glucose has returned to normal. And I said to him, how often do you want me to see you? And he said, About every 3 months. If I know I'm coming in to see you in 3 months, I'll stay on the program. Yeah. So there is a lesson there, even among doctors, okay. Doctor patients. Yeah.
Let's talk with some more folks here. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello. Yeah, am I on?
Yes.
Yeah. I had a question. My son's a first-year med student at SIU in Carbondale, and I just wondered if you've written anything in particular or if you'd have any advice just today about, you know, what he can do outside of, you know, work hard, study hard, and try to devote himself to his chosen vocation in the next few years. But at the end of this 4 years, what could he do to help him make a good decision that would serve him well in his career to follow?
Well, that's a wonderful question, and it also reveals what a lucky person he has in having a father like you. I would say that what he needs to do is learn the difference between among advisor, role model, and mentor. And once he has found out what a mentor is, try to attach himself to a mentor in medical school. Not to belabor the definition, but a mentor will have your son's best interests at heart and yet be very objective and very honest with him and tell him that perhaps he does not have the manual dexterity to be a neurosurgeon or he does not have the extreme intellect to be an electrophysiologist and that perhaps this field or that might better suit him. And if he can find a mentor, and he will be lucky to do so, but more likely to do so than a young woman for whom mentors are in short supply, I think that would serve him best.
Good. Do you have any of your particular writings or you know, articles or books that address you know, specific advice like this for med students?
Well, I do. I'm not here to hype a new book. I have a collection of stories coming out this summer by the University of Maine Press, and they have a website, and you can go to that website. The book's title is going to be Bedside, The Art of Medicine, and your son might like that.
Great. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. We've been talking a lot about medicine and not very much about writing. My apologies, because I really feel that that's a good subject, and it's a big part of your life, obviously, as you've talked about how you wanted to have the opportunity to continue to practice medicine, but that you also wanted to write as well, have the time to be able to do that. What is writing, to be able being able to do that, what does that do for you, do you think?
Well, first of all, let me just say that what has happened so far in this program has been very enjoyable for me and very rewarding, so that you needn't feel it incumbent that we talk about writing. For me, it has been a drive. It has been a drive really since grade school, and it gives me an additional dimension toward looking toward medicine. It gives me an additional dimension in terms of understanding patients and doctors and ancillary personnel, and it adds to a richness in my life. Let me give you a quick example. Mm-hmm. I just finished editing an anthology of poetry, which will be published this spring. These are poems by the great icons of poetry they are of interest to physicians. There is one poem there that talks about a doctor walking into a ward late at night, and he watches a nurse gently take a demented man who is wandering in the hall, tie his Johnny in the back, smooth his hair, and then gently guide him back to the room. Sees another nurse calming an upset woman who is confined to a chair with restraints, giving her a drink of water, wiping her chin. And the poem ends, "Now, tell me again why you don't believe in angels." And when I go into the intensive care unit late at night because of an acutely ill patient, and I see all of the nurses in the unit working as a team on this patient, They are covered with the mess of disease. They are disheveled from fighting to keep this patient alive and frantic with their job. That poem comes to mind. So that's what literature does for doctors, I think, whether you write it or read it.
We tried to get at least one more caller here, someone in Urbana. This will be line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
What foods and beverages tend to lower blood pressure, and which of them tend to raise blood pressure? Is there a good source of information on this?
Well, in brief, salty foods will raise blood pressure. And salty drinks like tomato juice, for example, that is not low sodium. The athletic drinks that are very high in sodium will tend to raise blood pressure in people who have a tendency for hypertension. There is really no drink that will lower blood pressure per se that I'm aware of, although there is some research that pomegranate juice, which my wife has now started stocking in our refrigerator, tends to be beneficial for heart disease. And I can tell you from personal experience that you can acquire a taste for that.
Thank you.
Sure. Oh,
thank you. Let me get back and ask you a question about writing and ask it for you in the kind of writing that you like to do for yourself. Do you feel that there is a particular kind of story that you want to tell, or that, you know, as you write, and I'm thinking about fiction, not so much, you know, things that maybe directly come out of your experience as a doctor, that you're drawn in a particular kind of direction, any particular themes?
Sure. Good question. Two themes. One is the undiscovered dimension of the patient. The patient who may have been visiting for you for years and whom you begin to take for granted and in a superficial sense seem to know. And then you find out that she was a steerage passenger on the Titanic and was one of the ones saved. And you realize that you have just not gotten to know this person. The other is the ethical dilemma, and it is the seemingly easy answer to medical ethics. What do you do with an impaired physician, for example? And I wrote a story about, at the request actually of a journal and an editor, wrote a story about an impaired physician. They were thinking they would get a story about a drunk, about some physician with a bottle in the bottom drawer. Mm-hmm. What they got instead was the quintessential professor, dedicated to patients and to teaching, whose wife becomes terminally ill. And he becomes so distracted by her illness that he begins to cut corners and do a poor job of taking care of patients. He is so revered by those around him that they cover his back and they begin to cover his mistakes. And so one then has the ethical question of whether something should be done about this impaired physician and whether it's ethical to cover up for him.
Yeah. So it sounds as if for you, it's a way, using the story form, using fiction form, is a way to maybe, you know, change the names to protect the innocent. That is, you're writing about, it sounds as if you're writing about things that perhaps you've seen or that you know. It's a way of saying, look, I'm telling you a story here, but don't ever forget that I've actually seen this. And maybe if you're talking to other doctors, you could say, and look, if you're all going to be honest, we can say you've seen this too. This is nothing that we don't know about. This is a way that we can talk about it and remove it maybe one step from real life. But let's never forget that that is real life.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And doctors understandably have problems with fiction that appears in medical journals. It's all supposed to be true. It's all supposed to be nonfiction. And often their initial reaction is this true? And I will get a letter that says, Dear Dr. Lacombe, is this true? Did this happen? And my answer says, all the time, or does it matter? Or it's really the lesson and not the truth of the matter, or whether it's fiction that's important.
Hmm.
Yeah.
We here in this country, we pay a lot per capita for health care, a lot more than a lot of other countries. But we're not healthier. There are a lot of places where they pay less per person. They pay less, and the population is healthier. So that would suggest that something about the way we're practicing medicine here doesn't quite square up? I know we're just about at the end, and this is a big question. But is there something that we could do, something that would be maybe simple and yet would not mean spending more money and would result in improved health for Americans?
There's no quick answer. I will tell you that it has been looked at and that tort reform is not the quick answer, although it will partially go to that. That is to say that if doctors are protected against lawsuit, if they do not order expensive tests, that would go part of the way. But a lot of this is the expectation of American society. English society, Japanese society does not expect the most expensive test and retesting the way our patients do. So it is going to involve a large re-education effort and a reordering of expectations by patients.
Well, we're at the point where we're going to have to finish. Our guest, Michael Lacombe, is a physician. He's a cardiologist, also author and poet. He's practiced medicine for over 30 years in rural Maine. He's the former director of cardiology at Maine General Medical Center in Augusta. He's done a lot of interviews, been profiled on some big television programs. He served as visiting professor at over 40 medical schools around the country. He's associate editor of the Annals of Internal Medicine. He's responsible for the On Being a Doctor section, one a very popular one that deals with medical humanities issues. He's authored a number of books, and maybe if you're interested in sampling some of his writing, you might look for this new book that will be coming out from the University of Maine Press this summer. Tell us again the title.
Bedside, The Art of Medicine.
All right. Well, thanks very much for being
here. Thank you for having me.